From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. In the year 2020, it will be 100 years since women got the right to vote in the U.S. Now, a group called Vision 2020 has its sights set on 100% voter turnout among women during the 2020 election. We'll talk with Lynn Yackel from Vision 2020 about how this year has played a pivotal role in mobilizing women to get involved in politics and how she's mobilizing the effort in Southwest Florida. Plus, wheelchair-bound athletes have a new forum in which to train and get fit. The Naples YMCA has a new program that not only provides coaching for wheelchair tennis, pickleball, and wiffle ball, but they also encourage veterans of the armed forces to get involved. We'll talk with the athletes and the coaches about how this partnership could lead to championship gold. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. When one finds themselves without the use of their legs, everything changes. And for athletes, it's a particularly big change. Later on in the show, we'll talk with wheelchair athletes about how they re-envisioned their fitness goals and talk with the leader of a local program that's inspiring the wheelchair user not only to stay fit, but to aspire to compete. But first, women have had the right to vote for nearly 100 years. And while women typically turn out to vote in greater numbers than men, still, only about 60% of eligible female voters actually cast a ballot. More staggering, though, is the divide in numbers of women who run for office. In spite of there being more women than men in the state of Florida, the state's legislature has 41 women and 119 men. Florida sends 23 men to represent the state at the national level in the U.S. Congress, and just 6 women. One woman who's seeking to turn that around is Lynn Yackel, who ran for U.S. Senate and is now the founder of Vision 2020. It's a new effort to get 100% of eligible female voters to the polls in the 2020 election. She joins us live here in the studio. Lynn, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Julie. It's great to be here.
We are talking about women in politics and in the voting booth. Do you have a comment or a question? You can give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. Lynn, you'll be speaking tomorrow at the League of Women Voters event in Fort Myers, which we should note is sold out already and has a waiting list.
It does.
A lot of interest in this topic, and the title of that presentation is Let's Act Like the Majority We Are. Can you tell me a little more about that thought?
I certainly can. It's been a phrase I've used for many years. I've been working on women's rights issues for several decades, actually, and it's one reason that I'm so focused on Vision 2020 now and the year 2020. If women would identify first by gender rather than by race or religion or whatever else it often is the case, we would be the majority of the population, and we could accomplish many things. In particular, we could get more women into senior leadership positions in government and business, which is where the decisions are made that affect our lives.
And they affect women and men.
I mean, and they do.
Yeah.
And families.
Yeah, and children as well. You're leading an initiative that's called Vision 2020. Can you tell me a little about the broader scope of that?
Yes, we started this in the year 2010 in collaboration with the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia because the focus is on the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment in the year 2020, granting women the right to vote. And, of course, that's of great interest to the Constitution Center. So we kicked it off, Vision 2020, with a conversation about women and leadership. And for 48 hours, delegates from every state in the U.S., 2 women leaders from each state, plus many large organizations that were allying themselves with Vision 2020, discussed how we could accelerate the pace of progress for women. It's just been glacially slow in terms of getting women into senior leadership positions, especially in business and government. So we have a goal of shared leadership among women and men, 50-50 ultimately in government and business, and we have a long way to go to get there.
Yeah, where does it stand currently?
Oh, it's under 20% in government, and it's the Fortune 500 CEOs, there's 6% are women. So there's a long way to go, and women on corporate boards are less than 20% overall. So that's one goal. Another is economic security for women, and that includes in the retirement years as well as in closing the pay gap. And then youth education, so that our young people learn about the achievements and contributions of women over history, which really those contributions are not included in our history books these days, and we really want to change that. And then finally, civic engagement. We want to see more women running for office, getting elected, serving at all levels, whether it's school board, state legislatures, U.S. Congress, and certainly it's time for a woman in the White House. And we want women to vote, because the fact that the suffragists struggled for 72 years to win that right for us, and there still are 1 out of 3 women who don't vote, that's just not acceptable. So we're really focused on changing that.
Well, I mean, to be fair, a lot of people don't vote. I mean, even
that's
a lot of men don't vote. I mean, so it's amazing how hard we fight for the freedom and the ability to vote in a democratic society, and still just over half actually go.
It's really horrifying. And in the primaries, which often are where women lose in their initial runs for office, there's a terrible voting percentage. And so we want to get people to focus on the primaries in their states, which are often very, very important, and then to realize the significance of their vote. And frankly, after what happened in 2016 in terms of an unexpected outcome, there are many more people, not only women, who are paying attention to this. I was talking to a young man recently who told me that he had never really taken his vote seriously, but now he realizes how important it is and that every vote counts. So we think we can turn that around in the year 2020.
Well, you mentioned primaries, and I know that I don't declare a party. You have to, don't you have to declare a party to be able to vote in the primaries? I
you
mean,
do.
That kind of cuts a lot of people out.
In certain states, you do. In Florida, that's true, and it's also true in Pennsylvania, which is where I live part of the time. And that is a problem, because a lot of people are independent. And I think increasingly, with the polarization of the parties, many people feel that they can't really identify with either party. So I hope that there will be changes in some of these voting laws as a result of the interest level that's there now, the public awareness.
Well, this year has seen some activism from women that a lot of people never have seen in their lifetime. And do you find it encouraging to see all these people coming to the marches, all the hats, and all the interest that women are showing in what's going on in government?
I think it's fascinating that those marches were so hugely successful, and the marches around the world, I think, surprised everyone. It's great, but the thing that I do know for a fact is that there were a lot of women at those marches who had not voted in 2016. And in fact, I was talking to a woman, a neighbor of mine on Sanibel Island, who had marched in Naples. And she was shocked at the number of women who she heard saying, "Oh, I wish I had only cast my vote this year." So, you know, the marches, I think, demonstrate the level of interest, but that has to be translated into action. And it's action not only in exercising the right to vote, in registering, in being educated, and then actually being mobilized and getting to the polls. That's what's going to make the difference.
The 2016 election was the first time that a woman received the presidential nomination from a major political party. She went on to lose to Donald Trump, which, as we can say, was an unorthodox candidate from the beginning. What are your thoughts on Clinton's historic nomination and then ultimately the defeat?
Well, there are two things I want to say about that. One is that it's the first time we've had women running in both major party primaries, with Carly Fiorina running in the Republican primary when the field was so crowded early on. I think it's wonderful that we had a woman as the nominee to the party, and that it gave an example of women's competence and leadership. And I honestly think that it was not the woman factor so much as the desire for change and the economy issues that some people saw, and looking to have a different kind of leadership that brought Donald Trump into the White House. But it's certainly time to have women running at that level. And in fact, we've had 45 presidents now. This is number 45, and not one woman. And that is really kind of hard to believe.
It is, when you especially look into the context of the rest of the world. And you mentioned Carly Fiorina, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about if whether there's any kind of partisan bent or angle with Vision 2020.
No, we are completely nonpartisan. We are headquartered at Drexel University in Philadelphia, where I'm the director of the Institute for Women's Health and Leadership in the College of Medicine. And this is a women's leadership initiative that is national in scope, totally nonpartisan. And in fact, we are very, very careful and thoughtful about that. We have women leaders who are Republicans in their state legislatures and Democratic mayors and a former Democratic governor of the state of Oregon. And it's a very much we want to include all women and make sure that we're building bridges across not only party divides, but the other kinds of divides I was talking about before, race and class, and you know, so that we get beyond the polarizing issues and find ways that we can all stand up together.
And find some commonality. We are talking about women in the voting booth and in political office with our guest Lynn Yackel, who leads Vision 2020. You can become part of our conversation, too, by giving us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So what is the Southwest Florida connection? You say that you're on Sanibel?
Yes. We've had a house on Sanibel, my husband and I and our children and grandchildren who love to come to Sanibel. We've owned a home there for many years. And prior to that, we spent a great deal of time on the Gulf Coast because my husband's parents lived in Clearwater. So we are very big fans of this part of Florida.
And this initiative is kind of getting a little foothold here too.
Yes. So we have delegates in every state, as I mentioned. And in Florida, we have four delegates, two on the East Coast and two stars here in Southwest Florida, as well as a member of our National Leadership Circle. Deborah Britton lives in Naples, and she has been on our National Leadership Circle from the very beginning. And then Sarah Owen, who's CEO of the Southwest Florida Community Foundation, and Samira Beckwith, who is the CEO of Hope Healthcare Services, are both delegates to Vision 2020, and they're very active and very important roles.
Mm-hmm. The Institute for Women's Policy came out with a study late last year looking at wage gaps, access to health care, and women living in poverty in the state of Florida. And they gave Florida a D-plus overall when it comes to the status of women. Do you think that more women involved in policymaking would be able to turn something like that around?
I have no doubt about it. The track record of women in elective office and in appointed positions in gubernatorial cabinets and that sort of thing has shown that women will act on the issues that they know and understand. And I think the poverty issue, the economic disparities would be certainly at the top of that list. So the issue of economic security, as I mentioned, is not only relevant to the pay gap, but to the enormous gap in retirement income between men and women, which is due to women having been in and out of the workforce. It's what I call the caregiving penalty. And women in overall have about a 14% lower income in retirement than men. And they live longer, as we know, and have more chronic illnesses. So that's something that needs major policy reform. And it's, again, one of the items on the Vision 2020 agenda.
And that definitely speaks to the demographics of Southwest Florida with our number of retirees.
Yes.
One interesting fact that came out of the study says that if women in Florida were paid the same as men, assuming identical education and experience and other factors, more than 57% of women in Florida would rise out of poverty. That's just if they were paid the same as men. Is wage equality a big part of what Vision 2020 is about?
It is a big part because, first of all, it's so unfair. And I think most people, including young children, get the concept of fairness. The AAUW, American Association of University Women, did a study a couple of years ago that tracked women and men coming out of college with essentially the same track records in college and the same grades and the same entry-level jobs. And after 1 year in the workforce, the women were already being paid less than the men. and that gap widened over time. So it is definitely an issue. And having grown up at a time when all anybody wanted to know when I came out of college was whether I could type, and I refused to type. I had a good education, and I wanted to do more than that. We haven't come very far in that regard. And it would change our whole society. You know, 42% of households are actually headed by women wage earners. So are they the primary breadwinners. And that's extremely significant in terms of fixing that economic issue.
Ideologically, I understand where you're going, but how does Vision 2020 want to see that happen? Do they want to see a federal mandate making equal pay something that's required, or do they want to see voluntary action by private organizations?
I think it's really about awareness again and fairness. And I think employers, when they focus on this, and I've seen it repeatedly actually, will take steps to make changes. And it's about having women on the boards of businesses. One of my very close friends has been on several corporate boards, and she has always ended up chairing the compensation committees. And she does that very intentionally because then she can look at the wage gaps between the employees and fix them. And so, and I heard the president of Brown University speak once, the woman who is not there now but had been there, and she talked about arriving at Brown and taking a look at the faculty salaries and evening them out, the exact same thing. So I trace all this back to the leadership issue.
And one way to get into leadership is to run for office, which is something that you did. So, I mean, I'm sure there are women out there that have gone to the marches, they've put on their pink hats, they've done their you know, complaining, and they're mad, they want to do something, but what can they really, really do? And that's run for office. So as someone who's run for office before, what kind of tips can you give people from that experience?
Well, first of all, it is an out-of-body experience, I will tell you. I mean, my year running for the U.S. Senate was like no other year in my life, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, although it took me a while to sort of figure that out. It really takes standing up and deciding that you want to make a difference and you want your voice to be heard and you want to represent people whose views and values and voices are the same as yours, which is one reason that my campaign got a great deal of attention. At the time I ran, there were only 2 women in the U.S. Senate. Now we have 21, which is definitely an improvement, but it's still only 1 out of 5. It's slightly over 1 out of 5. But women have to make the decision based on several things. First of all, you need to get help. And there are organizations now all over the United States that are training women to run for office, helping them to understand how to set up their campaign teams, how to raise money. That's a big obstacle for women. Women are not used to raising money. And I was fortunate because I had been running a nonprofit coalition where I was the fundraiser for the organizations. And so I knew who had money and I wasn't afraid to ask for it. And so getting over that hurdle is a big one. But also getting help from people and lining up supporters. And I just think the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers has done a lot of work on this, and they're one of our allied organizations. And they have definitely proven that when women run for office, they win or lose at approximately the same rate as men who are running, whether it's for an open seat or against an incumbent. But the problem is there are just not enough women running.
Well, it's hard to ask for help, and it's hard to ask for money. Those are two tough things, and I think psychologically that would be kind of tough to get over. But it's good to hear that there are organizations that are actually kind of setting up, you know, kind of places for women to go for advice when they are trying to put their hat in the ring.
And also organizations that are providing financial support and raising money for candidates. There are the Emily's List on the Democratic side. And then there's a similar organization on the Republican side. This is at the national and state levels. But I think people are generally willing to open up their pocketbooks if they really understand that the candidate is someone who is going to represent them. And again, what I found when I ran in, a number of years ago is that there were lots of women who told me they had never registered to vote. They had never cared about voting because they never saw anybody that they thought would represent their interests. And so that's really very key to this. And I think and it's a great experience. And, of course, being in a decision-making body is hugely important and also empowering.
What made you want to get involved when you did?
Well, first of all, I had grown up in a political family. This part got obscured a fair amount in my campaign, but my father was in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was elected when I was 5 years old. I grew up on a farm in Southern Virginia, and he ran for Congress, and we moved to Northern Virginia, and he was reelected 10 times, and after 22 years, he retired. By that time, I was out of college and married and living in Pennsylvania. So I worked on Capitol Hill in the summers, and I really was fascinated by the political process. I used to go sit in the galleries, and I wasn't afraid of it, and I think that's a big issue. It's not mysterious. It's not something that's that makes people scared. It's sort of getting over the fact that these people are any different than we are. And so that was one thing. And then I watched my senator, Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, grilling Anita Hill when she was testifying in the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court. And I was so appalled at the way my senator treated her and the fact that there was not a single woman on the Judiciary Committee. And then I realized that there were only two women in the U.S. Senate at that time. And as one of my colleagues said, 2% is okay for milk, but not for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, you brought up the lack of women in the room during the hearing. And there have been recently, just this year, and it's been a while since the Clarence Thomas hearings, there have been photo ops of political events shot in the Oval Office that have gotten attention for the lack of women in the shot. And mm-hmm. to the point that the female prime minister of Sweden, Isabella Lövin, had her picture taken of herself signing a bill surrounded by women colleagues. How do you think the U.S. stacks up against other countries when it comes to women in leadership roles?
We're way, way, way down the list of countries with women in elected office. I think I'm trying to remember what the last statistic I heard was, but it was certainly below the number 50 in terms of where the U.S. is. And I think it's really time to change that, and that we've seen enough problems in our political system that the recognition that women and men together can make larger contributions and solve problems in a more meaningful and representative way. I think all it's going to take is women voting and women running.
I just think it's so strange because America, as an American, I consider our country to be so advanced. I consider us to be, you know, cutting edge leaders and freedom. And that's how I perceive the country. But when you stack it up to women in leadership and then compare it to other countries, we just look like we're very far behind.
Well, if you look at the whole issue of equality, equality is the promise of our democracy. And the reality is that people are not equal in this country. And it's manifest in the leadership, I think. But my observation is that those people who have power become the guardians of the status quo, and they don't want to share it, and they don't want to relinquish it. And it shouldn't be about butting your head up against the barriers all the time. It really should be about people taking turns. That was my father's view, by the way, is that it was your responsibility as a citizen to step up for public service, but not as a career, as part of your life. He lived well into his 90s and led a fundraising campaign to build a medical school after he retired from Congress and did all kinds of other things. So, but he served believing that that was what people are supposed to do, and I would really support that.
And the Vision 2020 group is hoping to work on chipping away at this problem, this issue of inequality, by creating the dialogue and continuing to talk about it and making people aware of it rather than trying to mandate that people do this.
That's exactly right. And in fact, we have 100 allied organizations that represent well over 22 million people. I lost count sort of as we've been adding groups. But those organizations are all committed to the broad goals that we're working on. And we are convening them and connecting them and using the collective impact model to try to make positive change and step up the pace of progress. And I really think the model is exactly the right one in the time that we're living in. So really, the goal is to get lots of people to join us and, you know, just sign on to our website and get on our mailing list and, you know, become part of the message, which is a big part of what we do is the communications.
A lot of the messaging. And then so we're about to wrap up, but I wanted to ask you, what would you like to say to the women who have gone to these marches? What would you like to inspire them to do next?
I would like to encourage them to look ahead and plan ahead and get organized and work toward the next big elections. I'm not dismissing the midterm elections in 2018, but I think the next really important time is the year 2020. And we should use our energy and our experience and our resources to act and to thank the suffragists for winning us the right to vote, which they saw, by the way, as the first step toward women's equality. And we can make it the first step if we will just all act together. And that's the reason for my title as, you know, thinking about acting like the majority we are.
Yeah, when you think of those suffragists, I wonder if they anticipated things would move forward so slowly or if they expected it to be faster.
Oh, I know they expected it to be faster. And in fact, Alice Paul, who carried it across the finish line with the federal amendment, lived several decades longer and introduced the Equal Rights Amendment, which, of course, has never passed to the Constitution. And I think they would all be shocked as hard as they worked to win the right that everybody doesn't use it.
Yeah. Well, Lynn Yackel, I want to thank you for coming in ahead of your speech tomorrow with the League of Women Voters in Fort Myers to give us a preview because it is sold out. So we can't go, but at least we now know pretty much the contents and we know more about Vision 2020. The speech tomorrow is entitled Let's Act Like the Majority We Are. So I want to wish you best wishes in your campaign to get out the female vote for 100% in the year 2020.
Thank you, Julie. It was great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Coming up, being in a wheelchair is not the end of an athletic career or hobby. We'll talk with a local coach who's keeping the wheels on the court, and we'll meet an aspiring Paralympian coming up next.